Hello, and thank you for listening to our third podcast created by the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries Net Zero Portfolio Working Party. I'm Brandon Horwitz, co-chair of the Working Party and an actuary working in the area of investment governance, including the key area of responsible investment, also known as environmental, social, governance, or ESG investing. The Net Zero Portfolio Working Party has been established by the IFOA Sustainability Board to produce materials to help actuaries understand net zero investing. Our goal is to help actuaries navigate the many aspects of this important and constantly evolving area, and our output will include papers, podcasts, and potentially an interactive event. I'm joined today by two guests from RailPen, an organization offering pension scheme administration, asset management, and fiduciary services, including servicing the railways pension scheme. RailPen announced their net zero commitment in July this year, and I'm delighted to welcome two key people involved in designing and implementing this strategy, Michael Marshall, the head of sustainable ownership at RailPen, and Chandra Gopinathan, RailPen's sustainable ownership senior investment manager. Welcome, Michael and Chandra.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Could I ask you to please first introduce yourselves and just say a little bit about what you do at RailPen? So we'll start with Michael, if that's all right.
Sure. Thanks, Brandon. Well, I'm Michael Marshall, and I'm the head of sustainable ownership at RailPen. That means I manage a team of the seven of us now. But really, truly, what we do is collaborate very widely across the business with our investment management colleagues, our fiduciary colleagues, colleagues that talk to our scheme members, to our trustee board. And the purpose of all this is to integrate what we call sustainable ownership factors, but the industry at large tends to call ESG factors, including climate change, but not just climate change, to integrate those kind of things into the investment process, and into the funding process, and into the strategy at large. So we'll get onto the kind of things that we've done in a net zero context during the course of the podcast, but at a high level, that's what we do.
And Chandra, if you'd introduce yourself, please.
Sure. I'm Chandra Gopinathan. I work in Michael's team in sustainable ownership, and I'm predominantly in charge of the climate work stream, which includes everything from our net zero commitment, TCFD planning and preparation, and integrating climate risk across our various different portfolios.
Brilliant. Thank you, gentlemen. Now we're going to turn into the meat of our podcast. And I've got a few questions for you to help us understand net zero investing. And starting somewhat at the top, do you have a view as to whether net zero investing actually genuinely supports a reduction in real world emissions, or does it just reduce the emissions in a particular portfolio?
I can start there. So in my opinion, it has to be about real world emissions. People don't retire into an investment portfolio or something that exists only in the abstract. They retire into the real world. We have open defined benefit sections for our pension schemes. We'll be paying pensions throughout the rest of this century and hopefully beyond. So it is absolutely essential that all the actions and momentum that's being generated from things like COP26, but really have been going back years, that they contribute to impacts that actually affect companies and other actors in the real world. It's those companies that will still be around that need to transition in this transitional decade of the 2020s. Divesting from a company and saying, well, my emissions have gone down 30%, we could do that by selling a handful of stocks in certain carbon intensive sectors. But that arguably would make no difference to the real world. So our net zero plan, as we'll come on to, is all about trying to influence companies using the leverage that we have rather than washing our hands and walking away from the situation. It doesn't mean that divestment is never an option. It's part of the mosaic. But really, we need to be focused not on optimizing a portfolio in the abstract, but generating real world outcomes.
Chandra, anything you'd like to add?
I think Michael summarized it perfectly in terms of the real world outcomes and real world impact. I just add a little bit on the addressing externalities, which includes climate change and net zero, which is what we strive to achieve on a real world basis as opposed to a portfolio basis.
So just picking up, Michael, you said something very interesting about divestment and it to some extent being the easy route. And just because you've divested yourself of a firm and its emissions, that doesn't mean they're gone. I'm also very conscious that the words universal owner are used a lot in the industry, and I do believe Railpen used it as part of your net zero announcement in July. Could you help us understand what do you mean by being a universal owner, and how did that influence the way that Railpen has approached net zero?
Absolutely. So universal ownership, this concept has been around for a while. It's articulated in slightly different ways, but a very short and sweet way of describing it is that we own a little bit of everything because we're a large, diversified institutional investor. And more than that, we're a pension fund with long-dated liabilities. And since we have those characteristics, we're essentially captive to systemic risks like climate change, but not only climate change. And so what we really care about is not just shifting a few small positions and trying to manage climate change within a portfolio context by underweighting or overweighting or something like that. We want to try and prevent or at least mitigate the risk from crystallizing in the first place. That's what really matters to a universal owner, because of their long run liabilities and because of the fact they own a bit of all of the market. So they are exposed to the system itself. And then the influence that thought had on our net zero plan, I suppose there are sort of two. One is whether to do net zero at all. So from a universal owner perspective, net zero makes eminent sense. And I think we achieve alignment with our beneficiaries' objectives, not just in a financial planning sense and offering them a wage in retirement, but also from a world they retire into sense, although one could actually use climate change and link it back to financial outcomes if you wanted to make a sort of hardcore fiduciary duty argument. And then the second was the way in which you went about it. And this very much links back to the answer to the first question that you had. So it really matters to us that the way in which we go about net zero is not just to make a few equity overweights and underweights, but actually to focus on real world impact. So that was the influence that a universal owner perspective had on our net zero designs.
Chandra, anything you would add to that?
Yeah, I agree with Michael on the integration of active investment strategies, active ownership approach, addressing externalities included but not limited to climate change and beyond. And the one thing I would add is there is also the element of collaboration with peer asset owners and in some cases the state and the market as well, particularly as it relates to network benefits, whether it is on the individual engagement side or it is on the policy side as it relates to climate change or other issues, which is a key part of the active and universal ownership approach to sustainability as well.
Oh, thank you. I'm also conscious that you will have done a fortune of work to get here, and your announcement this summer of your net zero approach will have been months, if not years, in the making. So be really interested for our listeners to understand how have you actually approached getting to net zero from a practical perspective, and what were some of the key steps that you went through in the process?
Sure, I can talk at a high level and then maybe hand over to Chandra for a bit of the detail or maybe even the implementation, what comes next side of things. But in terms of getting a detailed roadmap out there, approved and published, the first stage here was to set up an internal climate working group, which I co-chair with our chief investment officer, and which has five members of our investment management team and five members of our fiduciary team. So really people that are making decisions and the people that with the credibility and gravitas to take the what we discuss in the climate working group meetings and bring it back to their local team. So we couldn't have done this without that particular piece of governance. The second thing was to understand and distill what it means for a pension fund to be net zero. It's complicated enough for one company operating in a single sector to know what it is for that company to be net zero over the course of decades, let alone a diversified portfolio of many sectors, many regions, many asset classes, what it means for such an institutional investor to be net zero. So we had to understand that and digest it. We use that to make a plan, get a plan on paper with targets and milestones and a roadmap. And then we needed to test that to make sure we weren't making a fiduciary duty error, that we weren't committing to something that would harm the ability of RELPEN to meet pension obligations for our beneficiaries. And then finally, to communicate what we did, what we come up with to the wider world in an appropriate way. And I think we weren't the first to make a net zero promise, but I think that what we have done very well is to come up with a detailed roadmap that isn't only a promise, that actually says how we will get there. So it was, Brandon, it was a lot of work. And so that's why we published in July. But Chandu, I don't know if you want to talk about either more detail on that or perhaps the implementation side of things.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. The governance process and the overall high level overview and analysis was as Michael outlined. I mean, for us, the detail really is around the groundwork that was done before we went out with the net zero plan, the reverse portfolio analysis that we did as well in conjunction with a data scenario analysis provider on what it means for our portfolios, what it means for our fiduciary duty. That was a key part of the preparation. And then the next steps around the engagements with specific companies. So when we were ready to publish our net zero plan, we were also ready to discuss and commence our engagements with the key emitters. We knew what our next steps were. Now it's just time to get to work, and which we have started on. And that's basically our next step going forward.
I'll just bring in one other point here, Brandon, that I think might be interesting for your listeners, is the touch points and the sponsorship from senior people in the organization. So RELPEN is quite a complicated pension scheme, although we try to make the governance as clear as possible. So we had quite a few stakeholders in our process. So notably the trustee board of the Railways Pension Scheme. And so the sponsorship and the encouragement and the understanding that the trustee board were able to offer us was absolutely key. We couldn't have come up with what we did without them. And then also, as I say, I co-chair that climate working group with the chief investment officer, but right across the piece, across the executive, and also the committee which formally approved our plan, the asset management committee. Really, if I could offer some advice to people that are thinking about this in your listenership, it would be every 10 minutes spent understanding, distilling, and talking to your key stakeholders, that's never wasted. Every 10 minutes pays a dividend.
That's really helpful, Michael. And you know, it's very clear you needed that top-down support from your stakeholders, and then, you know, so to speak, bottom-up support thinking about what your membership would want. But I'm also conscious that this is a highly, highly complicated process to actually build the roadmap and build the approach. And I understand that you and many other firms do collaborate and share best practices, and that there are a number of net zero investing frameworks, including things like the Paris Aligned Investment Initiative, the Net Zero Investment Framework, or NZIF, as I understand it's called. Did RELPEN make use of any of these frameworks or these alliances? And you know, what did you find if you were doing that as part of your development of your roadmap?
Absolutely. So our roadmap is based on the Paris Aligned Investing Initiative's Net Zero Investment Framework. There are other competing frameworks, if you like, if you want to call it competing, in the industry. But I would say that actually these frameworks have more in common than they do than they differ. So we use the Net Zero Investment Framework partly because we were already members of the IIGCC, already plugged in to the IIGCC. By the way, the IIGCC, the Institutional Investor Group on Climate Change, oversees, or before it went global, oversaw the Paris Aligned Investing Initiative, got it set up, and got the first net zero investment framework methodologies out to consultation. And just to sort of emphasize that point, because I think it's important about the compatibility of different frameworks, it is as compatible as it can be with other frameworks. It's compatible with the Asset Owner Alliance target setting protocol. And the framework was put to public consultation and was genuinely receptive to the comments that were received back, and made some edits to try and make it as compatible as possible. So that's really been the backbone of our of our net zero plan. And we're fortunate enough to have been on the steering committee for the Paris Aligned Investing Initiative. And we also have contributed some of RailPen's own internal resource to the formation of some of the methodologies that have been part of the framework. So co-opting, if you like, people into working groups. And so we can actually have an influence on the framework. We also like the fact that the NZIF, the Net Zero Investment Framework, is broader than what's in the scope of some of the other frameworks. So notably, it includes things like policy engagement, and dialoguing with policymakers is really important for RailPen. And it also is the single framework that both asset owners and asset managers can cohere around. So you have the Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative, which is also using NZIF as its methodological backbone. So, you know, we're talking about the same things, the same concepts, using the same language, the same terms, same timeframes. So we found it a very, very helpful document.
Chandra, anything from your side that you would add?
No, I think Michael summarized it perfectly there. So thank you.
Great. So my understanding of these various different frameworks is obviously they start at the top with an ambition or a commitment towards net zero. But very quickly, that needs to turn into some real practical targets of what you're going to do. I wonder if you could talk us through how you approached coming up with your targets, including any metrics which you use to help measure if you're on track towards those targets.
In terms of the metrics to start with, I mean, there is clearly an understanding across investors on what sort of metrics are needed. There are pros and cons around each of those metrics. You do have an absolute emissions measure, which can be helpful, but does have drawbacks that it doesn't take into account the prospective intensity, and it may be clouded by the size of the company itself, and there may be advantages, disadvantages to larger companies versus smaller ones. While just looking at the emissions intensity poses exactly the opposite challenges, where you do have a focus just on the intensity, not on the size, not on the relevance of that company to a stock index, for example. So there are pros and cons to both. But given that the goal is around real world decarbonization and real world emissions reductions, we started off with an absolute emissions approach. So looking at absolute emissions as our key metrics, and then looking at the NZIF approach and the PCAF definitions for what's called financed emissions. So as to what percentage of those, or what portion of those emissions are relevant to our portfolio? What are we funding exactly? So absolute emissions and financed emissions, I would say, were the key metrics we selected. There is also an overlay around weighted average carbon intensities, just so we offset some of the challenges that exist with the absolute emissions approach as well. So we're not necessarily favoring large companies which have high carbon intensities, balancing those out. And once we had those metrics in place, then the target settings was really about understanding and contextualizing things to our own portfolio. And what that means is to be able to get a handle of what our portfolio looks like. And our analysis was largely on the public equities and bond side, so which is about 67% of our overall portfolio. So we started off with very simply looking at what is our asset allocation, bonds plus equities, what is our sector allocation, and how much of allocation do we have to high emission sectors and high emissions countries. So look at your energy, aviation, transport, all of those material high emission sectors exposure, look at the particular countries that they're involved in, and look at what portion of your overall portfolio, both in terms of value and in terms of financed emissions, comes from there. So that at a very high level gives you a good idea of where you are in context of starting point of your emissions footprint, and where you can potentially hope to get to in terms of a decarbonization trajectory, depending on which country and sector you're exposed to. So using all those parameters, we then did a simple mathematical average to see what we could potentially achieve. And that was sort of what we used to estimate and set what our targets, potential targets, could be in 2025, 2030, and 2050.
Brilliant. Now that makes a lot of sense. And thank you for laying that out for us so clearly. I'm also very conscious that ability to articulate those targets is going to be very, very data dependent. And this is a initiative which requires some decent quality data as an input for you to be able to do your measurements. Are there any insights you can share with us as to how you went about selecting your data providers to do the analysis on your underlying investments?
I can start off with that, and I'll hand over to Michael for additional comments that he has. So in terms of climate data, yes, the situation is evolving. Data is definitely improving. It's gotten a lot better over the last 2-3 years. It's still not perfect, particularly when it comes to scope 3 emissions data. There really are still a lot of challenges that need to be resolved. But what we also noticed was there is a disconnect between climate data used for climate science or from climate science and the contextualization of that data towards investment portfolios. So for us to be able to work with providers who understood both was very important. So looking at providers who understood equity indices, who understood, you know, bond indices, understanding private market portfolios, and understanding how this climate data and climate trajectories, decarbonization trajectories fit into the investment portfolio context was very important. So marrying those two together for our initial net zero plan as well, and for our climate scenario analysis and TCFD analysis, that is a key aspect. We have certain minimum standards and beyond for what we want in terms of data coverage and in terms of climate data accuracy that we need and proficiency within particular asset classes. And at the same time, also looking at a more holistic understanding that the data provider needs to have around contextualizing these things towards specific investment portfolios. So Michael, would you add anything to that?
Yeah, my contribution would be, so what Chandra was just talking about relates to the test that I mentioned, the testing of the net zero plan that we put on paper to see if we were making a fiduciary duty error or not in going forward with a commitment to net zero and all that entails. And so we used a provider that was capable of doing the kinds of things Chandra outlined. There's also emissions data providers, and this might be where some of your listeners are starting. And what I mean by emissions data providers is, if you're invested in an index of equities, let's say it's 2,000 stocks, if you want to find out the financed emissions that are associated with that index, then you need someone to provide you with GHG data for each constituent of that index. And I think if you're thinking about procuring some data on this, there are a few things that really matter. One is coverage. So what is the extent to which data provider A versus data provider B can cover the index in which you're invested? The second thing is the estimations for companies that don't report their own GHG data. So how does each provider estimate the blanks? Some of the modeling is quite good, and some of it is quite simplistic. The price is important. The prices can vary. The licensing is really important, because if you're hoping to publish this information or to share it with a number of individuals internally, then you need to make sure there aren't any bits of small print that prevent you doing that. And lastly, I'd say the format. So depending on how you want to share this information, it may just be that a PDF is fine for you, but if you want to do something slightly whizzier, like share it through internal data warehousing and other tools that you might have developed internally, you need to make sure that the information is coming in the right format. So those are the key things. If you're starting to look at this and starting to procure suppliers for that exercise, those are the things I'd look at.
Brilliant, guys. I think that's phenomenally insightful. So there's just one more question that I'm sure everybody would value your insights on, which is, now that you're a decent way along your journey, are there any key challenges which you would highlight that others might come across, and how you overcame them, and any other sort of nuggets or words of wisdom for people starting off on this journey?
Sure. What I would start off with is that it is a message of hope, really. There are lots of data around. There are methodologies that have been around for going on a year now that have increasing amounts of consensus around them. So there are lots of tools in the toolkit that enable people to just to get cracking and get started with this. So I'm happy to talk challenges, but firstly, there's a lot to be cheerful about. On the challenges side, when we first started looking at this, some asset classes were harder to think about than others, particularly private markets, real estate, infrastructure, so the unlisted side of things. And some of the methodologies around then were a little immature, but that is changing. That is changing very rapidly, and there are more methodologies coming out and RELPINs contributing to the development of those. Secondly, data. So I mentioned about GHG data just a minute ago. There's good availability in public markets. There's not as good availability in unlisted assets. And sometimes the cost of acquiring that data can be quite high. And there's this sort of familiar question, or at least be familiar to ESG practitioners, as to who bears that cost. And the implication from some of the suppliers is that, well, it should be the asset owner, the end investor, that bears the cost. So the cost of getting data can be a challenge. But Chandra, I don't know if you want to talk further about challenges.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. As Michael outlined, there are still ongoing challenges. I would say there are both in terms of the extent of data that's available, particularly scope 3, and the coverage and the depth and the breadth of data that's available across asset classes. So private markets is still a problem. Proxies are still widely in use. Estimation methodologies are still there, but not standardized. All of these things, I'd say, are challenges going forward. I mean, these are challenges just with getting the emissions footprint in place, and then you have the emissions scenarios and trajectories that are even more challenging. The one thing I'd touch on is also in terms of, and this isn't specifically a data challenge as such, but more a decarbonization trajectory challenge, where you know, there is still a lack of clarity around how certain sectors will decarbonize and what their pace of decarbonization is likely to be. All of these are based on projections, based on a lot of incumbents, large size incumbents, in setting business plans, setting strategies about how the decarbonization is going to work longer term. There are some sectors like steel and metals and mining, et cetera, which do have questions, large scale sort of question marks around how the decarbonization is going to take place and whether there will be disruption within those sectors and how the pathway is going to evolve over time. And I think that is a pretty crucial question that still hasn't been answered. And that's something that, so we are quite conscious about keeping track of what we don't know and not making those assumptions and absorbing information as it comes along, because I think that is a big part of our net zero journey, becoming more equipped and more aware as and when these things evolve within the industry. I think that's going to be key to staying on top of things and being a bit more flexible in our approach as well. We do have the interim, the short-term and the long-term targets, but there is a lot of data that's evolving, and it's evolving at a pretty rapid pace. So keeping on top of it, both from the companies, the portfolio companies that are involved, from the data providers who are involved, all of those sorts of things, and marrying those together and staying on top of it becomes a key part of the net zero journey as well.
Brilliant. Guys, that is a phenomenal amount of insight and very generous sharing of your experience for all of our listeners. I think that's all we've got time for today, and it's a lot to digest. So I'm sure people will be really doing so. And I'm probably taking a look at your excellent publication from July, where you set this out in full technical color and with all sorts of fantastic charts and tables. So I do commend the RailPen Net Zero Roadmap to anyone who hasn't had a look at it, and full credits to Michael and Chandra for your and your team's excellent work on it. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time. That's all we've had time for, but do watch the space for more podcasts and more material, which we do plan to publish. And to learn more about the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries sustainability work, please do visit actuaries.org.uk and look for the Sustainability Board, where you will find a lot of information, including curated reading lists, guides to sustainability, written by actuaries for actuaries. And do keep on learning. I think there's lots for us to know in this space, and still lots of work to do. Thank you so much, Michael and Chandra.
Thank you, Brent.